Now I'm thinking about whether or not I should get this new bivalent vaccine or booster. How should I be thinking about it?
In general, I think it's really important for people to get it by Halloween.
By Halloween? Spooky!
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN and Eureka's KGOE, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW, Lancaster, Pennsylvania's WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, in Palinville, New York on WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Burden Square Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. And those are just the affiliates who run us 5 days a week. There's a whole bunch more who are also really good. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today as we continue to fight like hell every single day to make you and me moderately smarter, which really shouldn't be hard at this point, at least when it comes to me. Hello, Desi Doyen.
Hey.
Hey, good news.
Good.
There is now a new version of the COVID vaccine, you may have heard or you may not have heard, with added protections for the latest variants of the deadly virus, now available in booster form at a friendly doctor's office or pharmacy near you, just in time for the fall and winter holidays. We will talk about that in a bit, but largely because it raises an interesting point. How many of these shots are we going to have to get before the pandemic is officially ended, much less COVID eradicated entirely? Well, thanks to something that Ronald Reagan did in 1987, a gift to Big Pharma, if you will, the answer is we may never be able to eradicate this virus, at least as long as the pharmaceutical industry stands to keep making big, big bucks, thanks to taxpayer dollars. Anyway, I will explain all of that shortly with my guest, along with some pretty cool related news that the state of California is now officially in the insulin manufacturing business.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yes, we are. I feel like I'm a stockholder, I guess, in that. Anyway, that and much more is ahead. First, the quest for criminal accountability for our former president continues on all fronts today. I know that everyone is justifiably freaking out about the literally bonkers ruling recently by the Trump-appointed judge down in Florida, Eileen Cannon, who is pretty much at this point serving as the defense lawyer with benefits, the benefit of being the judge in his case for Donald Trump, pretty much giving him everything that he wants, no matter how unprecedented or insane that it may be. And make no mistake, it is unprecedented and insane for things like the judicial branch to order the stoppage of a criminal investigation by the executive branch, to stop it dead in its tracks mid-investigation, much less, an active probe into the theft of highly sensitive national security documents. Anyway, as that matter is getting a lot of coverage elsewhere today, and the case is still moving quickly, and the DOJ appeal to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals is almost guaranteed to happen very soon, at least I hope. Given Judge Cannon's most recent decision to appoint a special master to review highly classified documents stolen by Trump, retrieved by the FBI, to make sure that somehow, according to this special master, they don't belong to the former president and are actually classified. As this judge says outright in her most recent ruling, she's not persuaded that they are. As noted, bonkers and unprecedented. So, with that said, let's touch base on a non-insane case that is moving forward against the same criminal former president. The one that, at least until the Mar-a-Lago documents case came about, I thought would be the first one to bring indictments. I still think that is the case when it comes to these criminal investigations, and this would be the one by the Fulton County District Attorney, Fonnie Willis, in Atlanta, Georgia, where we've got a bit of an update today, courtesy of the Washington Post. The prosecutor investigating efforts by Trump and his allies to challenge the election results in Georgia. He was not trying to challenge the results, Washington Post. He was trying to steal them. Yes. That prosecutor said this week that her team has heard credible allegations that serious crimes have been committed, and she believes some individuals may see jail time. Of course, I should note, you don't see jail time for challenging election results. You see jail time for trying to steal elections. Anyway, Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis told the Washington Post, quote, "The allegations are very serious. If indicted and convicted, people are facing prison sentences," unquote, she said. Well, I like the sound of that. Thought you might as well. No decision, she told the Post this week, will be made for months, however, on whether there will be indictments, and most notably if Trump himself will face charges. But at least 17 people now have been notified. They are targets of the criminal investigation, meaning they could eventually face charges. So far, that group of known targets includes Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani and the state's 16 fake Trump electors who created unofficial documents proclaiming themselves to be the true electors and that Donald Trump was the winner of Georgia's electoral votes, even though he was not. More importantly, as Willis told the Post, more targets will be added to the list soon, she said. Willis would not discuss any of the targets by name, has not said if she's willing to charge the former president. Trump could be called to appear as a witness before the special grand jury that was convened this spring as part of the investigation, said Willis. Well, he could be called as a witness. Hard to believe that he would be called as a witness, but not as a target, given that he was pretty much in charge of this entire conspiracy. And yes, she is investigating it as a conspiracy. I'll get to that in a moment. She said on whether that she would seek Trump's testimony or not, quote, "A decision is going to have to be made, and I imagine it's going to be made late this fall." Good. During a Thursday interview with right-wing radio host Hugh Hewitt, Trump said that the alternate elector slates, which is part of her investigation, was, quote, "very common."
What?
They are not very common.
Oh, okay.
In any way, shape, or form. This is Trump claiming, oh, this happens all the time. There's always people putting forward alternate slates of electors in presidential elections. And by the way, of course, both the House January 6th Committee and the Department of Justice are both also now investigating the fake electors plot in a whole bunch of states, not just Georgia. In addition to that fake electors plot, Willis is looking at criminal wrongdoing in calls that Trump and his allies, including Senator Lindsey Graham, made to Georgia officials. False statements made to lawmakers, harassment of election officials, and the tampering of election systems in one county in southern Georgia. That would be the Coffee County software breach that you have heard about on this program. It was discovered by our friend and frequent guest, Marilyn Marks, which we have reported on extensively here for months, since April, I believe. And now Fani Willis's office is also looking into it. And I believe so is the Department of Justice as well. Willis said she anticipates wrapping up the fact-finding stage of her now very broad-reaching conspiracy probe before the end of the year, the fact-finding stage, even as she continues to expand the reach of the probe. She said that she will stop all public activities like calling witnesses during the month leading up to the general midterm election. So everything will pretty much pause, at least publicly, for the final 3 weeks of October and the first week of November. And when the special grand jury has finished hearing from witnesses, it is expected to provide Willis with a report that could include their recommendations for indictments. You will then decide which individuals, if any, to charge. She said, "We are going to be done calling witnesses by the end of this year. Period." Unquote, she said. Probe has already seen appearances from many high-profile witnesses, including Giuliani, who was informed last month that, yes, he is a target. Since she opened the case following the release of the phone call in which Donald Trump is heard asking, threatening Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find additional votes needed to flip the election from Biden to Trump, Willis's probe has grown and represents, along with the ramped up federal inquiry, a serious threat that criminal charges could be brought against Donald Trump and his allies. So there's a whole lot that she is looking into. Giuliani's and others approaching Georgia state lawmakers and lying to them, trying to convince them to commit election fraud, essentially. She's also examining that call to Georgia officials by Trump and also Lindsey Graham, who also made some similar calls. She's also looking at the attempts to pressure and threaten election workers like Ruby Freeman, the Fulton County election worker who testified about threats to her and her daughter during the January 6th committee hearing. Willis told the Post, "I hate a bully. Obviously, I think we would find it offensive to bully an election official to influence an election." So she's looking at that, along with the fake electors.
There's just so much.
There's so much here. It's huge. I thought this would be the first one to come in, and I think it still might be, because the other ones are pretty huge, too. But she is looking at a whole lot.
Yes, and it does take time to do it right.
Especially when you're looking at a broad conspiracy. Willis's petition for an appearance by Sidney Powell, which has recently been added regarding the breach, the software breach of voting systems in Coffee County. Her petition for an appearance by Powell notes that in addition to Coffee County, there is evidence that Powell was involved in similar efforts in Michigan and Nevada. And though I'm aware of the claims about similar software breaches that the Trumpers took in, Michigan, Georgia, Colorado, I'm aware of the claims about Nevada, but I've not seen information on where or when or how that actually took place. In any event, Willis has suggested that all of this could, in fact, be prosecuted under Georgia's conspiracy and racketeering laws, which, by the way, greatly increases the imprisonment penalties that anyone charged and convicted here could face. Very sad. State anti-racketeering laws, also known as RICO laws, were enacted decades ago to fight organized crime. The RICO statute in Georgia has been used by Willis and others before to prosecute an array of high-profile cases. So she is not new to this. For example, in 2014, Willis was one of the lead prosecutors securing convictions and guilty pleas from 30 Atlanta public school teachers and administrators. Remember that? Implicated in a scandal to cheat on student tests? That was her. That was Fani Willis. She told the Post the RICO statute allows you to tell jurors the full story of a complex conspiracy, noting that Georgia law permits investigation of seemingly disparate acts, even if those happen outside of a prosecutor's home county. It is a great statute for prosecutors, she said, which I will take as good news as well. We knew, you know, she had brought in an experienced RICO prosecutor to the probe, I believe, last year.
On top of herself being an experienced RICO prosecutor.
Right, but someone who specializes in that in particular, in conspiracy. So good to hear that she is still a fan of using that tool in this case. Just wanted to give you an update on that because we haven't talked about that much, and it's been growing larger and more serious in recent months, but it is still underway and it should wrap up at least as far as the witness testimony and so forth before the grand jury by the end of the year. So that's coming. And one more story before we turn to my guest and to COVID and to the big pharmaceutical company ripoff that is helping to keep us all sicker than we need to be. Following the final primary elections of this year for the midterm elections this past Tuesday, we reported on the winner of the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire. That would be retired Brigadier General Don Balduck, who will now run against Democratic U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan for what Republicans have seen as a very flippable seat this year, given that Hassan won 6 years ago by just barely more than 1,000 votes out of something like 700,000 that were cast back in 2016. So, Balduck is a Trump-supported, far-right-wing conspiracy theorist and 2020 election denier, as we noted when he won on Tuesday. He has suggested the FBI should be abolished entirely. He's called for to get rid of the 17th Amendment. That is the direct election of senators by the people. He's called for that to be abolished. He also has called New Hampshire's fairly popular and moderate by today's Republican Party standards, Governor Chris Sununu, a, quote, Chinese communist sympathizer. That's the kind of guy he is. But now that he has won the nomination and he needs to appeal to a more moderate electorate in order to win the general election, suddenly he's decided to change his tune about the 2020 election for some reason, which he had sworn was stolen by Joe Biden. During a debate with fellow GOP New Hampshire Senate hopefuls last month, Balduck bragged about signing a letter falsely claiming that Donald Trump won the 2020 election, claiming he stood by that letter. But, well, now that he won on Tuesday, Balduck suddenly found a new position, a different position, as he made clear on Fox News this week.
And one of the things that Maggie Hassan, the Senate incumbent, will say is that you are an election denier, that you deny that President Biden won the 2020 election. And there's this from August 14th when you had a debate. Watch here.
I signed a letter with 120 other generals and admirals saying that Trump won the election, and damn it, I stand by my election.
Do you stand by that today?
So, you know, we live and learn, right? And I've done a lot of research on this, and I've spent the past couple of weeks talking to Granite Staters all over the state, mm-hmm. from every party. Mm-hmm. And I have come to the conclusion, and I want to be definitive on this. Mm-hmm. The election was not stolen.
Oh.
Was really? There fraud? Yes. Uh-huh. Is that a concern of Granite Staters all over the state? Yes, there is. Is there a responsibility for public servants and elected positions to ensure that our citizens have faith in their voting system? Yes. Uh-huh. But elections have consequences. And unfortunately, President Biden is the legitimate president of this country.
Oh, wow.
Well, nice of you to say that, General.
Don't get whiplash on that heavy 180 you just did.
Right? Damn it, I stand by. I'm not switching horses, baby. Oh, I've won the election? I'm switching horses, baby.
I mean, he's not the only one. There are lots of these radical Trumpist Republicans who have won their Republican nominations. They're all pulling back on their really radical right-wing positions now in order to try to fool voters in time for the general.
He's the first one that I've heard going just, you know, 180 on the election being stolen. Suddenly, he's done some research in the last 5 minutes, and he's discovered what he hasn't known over the past year and a half, that actually Joe Biden won. What a pathetic, cowardly loser. These folks will, they will say, these liars will say anything and everything they need to do to try to win an election. Hopefully they will pay a price for it from voters this November. But seriously, I mean, there is no lie too big to tell, even for a retired brigadier general. No lie too big, even if it endangers American democracy itself, because now, well, you know, he's got to win power. What a bunch of pathetic losers, all of them. I hope the folks in New Hampshire notice. I'm sure they will, right? All right, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with our own head-snapping 180, sort of, to a different topic. Though it's also something, by the way, that, you know, loser right-wingers like Bolduc and friends have been more than happy to lie about, even if it kills people. So a quick break. We'll come back with some COVID news and how a gift to the pharmaceutical industry by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s means that we have to keep taking new booster shots today to avoid getting killed by COVID or killing our loved ones in 2022 and beyond. That's next on the Bradcast with Bradblog.com's own Ernest A. Canning. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and Bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I want a new drug.
Welcome back to the Bradcast, Brad Friedman from Bradblog.com. A new drug indeed. And by the way, that song from the 80s, Huey Lewis and the News, kind of perfectly sets the stage for where we're going in this conversation. But let's start here. The White House COVID response coordinator said this week that Americans should get their new updated Omicron-specific booster shot no later than Halloween, if at all possible. Speaking on a podcast this week, Dr. Ashish Jha explained that A, Halloween on October 31 is an easy date to remember, but also because B, quote, 3 weeks after Halloween is Thanksgiving. And there's a lot of travel, and you're seeing family, and you're seeing friends, and a few weeks later, it's the holidays.
The idea here is, as you think about the fall and winter, we know respiratory viruses circulate at much higher levels in the fall and winter. It's a really good time to get yourself protected. And even if you yourself are on the low-risk side, you're going to have family and friends you're going to see. You don't want to be the person who gives it to your grandma. You don't want to be the person who gives it to your vulnerable friend who's immunocompromised. Lots of good reasons for people to go get it this fall.
True. No one wants to kill grandma. Don't be that person. The new shots from both Pfizer and Moderna, which target both the original COVID strain and now, finally, Omicron's BA5 and BA4 subvariants, are available to a wide swath of Americans who have received their primary vaccination series already. If you have a high risk of severe COVID, for example, you're older than 50, you're immunocompromised, or have other underlying medications, you may want to get the new shot much earlier than Halloween, says Jha. Likewise, if you only recently got a COVID vaccine or recovered from a COVID infection, you may want to wait a little bit. The CDC says you need to be at least 2 months out from your last dose of any COVID vaccine and should consider waiting 3 months if you've recently had the virus itself. COVID shots typically take 2 or 3 weeks post-injection to ramp up to full protection, making Halloween your sort of last chance before the Thanksgiving holiday. That protection tends to last for about 3 or 4 months before beginning to wane. Dr. Jha said it's better to get the new shot sooner rather than later, urging people to avoid waiting until November or December if they can, as an extra layer of protection that will be badly needed during the fall and winter when immunity from previous vaccines wanes and people spend a lot more time indoors. The weather during those seasons also turns the air cold and dry, making it easier for tiny droplets of the virus to survive in the air when people sneeze and cough or talk. New U.S. cases rose to a then record high last year in December with a 7-day average of more than 265,000 cases per day. That mirrored a similar surge in late 2020. So even if you aren't worried about getting the virus yourself, says Jha, it's important to remember that you can still spread it to high-risk loved ones during fall and winter social gatherings. He and the CDC also noted this week that it's just fine to get both the COVID booster and this year's annual flu shot at the same time. Just in case you're wondering, which is what I plan to do myself very soon. Wish me luck. According to New York Times columnist and researcher Zeynep Tufekci, the new so-called bivalent vaccine for COVID will provide a better response to the most threatening variants today, but probably to future variations as well. Because when the immune system faces different versions of the same virus, it generates broader protections overall, she writes. She describes the availability of the new vaccines as terrific news, noting that, quote, not only will a booster with the new vaccines decrease the likelihood of infection and severe illness and help reduce transmission of the virus, it could also decrease the likelihood of developing long COVID, which has continued to plague many who have been infected, even if the infection wasn't fatal, including many younger victims who, even after no longer testing positive, continue for months to have debilitating symptoms. Some marathon runners, for instance, have reported having problems even walking a half a mile after getting sick and staying sick with long COVID. Due to little fanfare for new availability of these updated vaccines, along with what Tufekci describes as unfounded skepticism of them, she fears that too few people might get them, and lots of people who need not get sick, suffer, or die will, in fact, get sick, suffer, or die. For the first time in the pandemic, she notes, manufacturers have capitalized on the potential of mRNA technology to begin distributing a COVID vaccine that perfectly matches the currently circulated strain of the virus, a feat that had long seemed improbable. So, yes, this is terrific news, at least here in the U.S., where the bivalent version of these vaccines by both Pfizer and Moderna should now be easily available. But in the rest of the world, not only are the new booster shots far less available, so is the original vaccine series, which means no matter how many shots smart Americans continue to receive, we're never really going to actually beat this virus, sadly. But there's a reason that these shots, more than 2 years into the pandemic, are not available worldwide. As the Brad Blog's long-toiling legal contributor Ernest A. Canning explained this week at the blog, you will be shocked to learn it has to do with money, specifically pharmaceutical industry profits. Even though the hugely profitable companies like Pfizer and Moderna, who developed these life-saving vaccines, did so thanks to tens of billions of dollars of government largesse. Taxpayer money for R&D, which decades ago would have meant that the government owned the patent rights, the intellectual property rights, so that we would then be able to release the formula for use around the world, which of course would make Americans much safer and less likely to die from what we now know to be an otherwise defeatable disease. We should be both relieved and outraged, wrote Canning this past week at bradblog.com. Relieved that earlier this month, the CDC and FDA approved a new round of booster shots specifically redesigned to address new variants of the deadly COVID virus. But outraged because despite the expenditure of tens of billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars on research and development, the pharmaceutical industry's refusal to waive its gifted patent rights prevented a global rollout of the COVID vaccines. In turn, writes Ernie, that refusal resulted in the need for the new booster shots in the first place. We should also be outraged, he says, because the industry's refusal to waive their patent rights has helped to kill at least 6.5 million people worldwide with no end in sight, and outraged because this will, in all likelihood, not be the last newly reconstituted booster shot needed, as at least 2/3 of the world's epidemiologists believe that the failure to provide global vaccinations will give rise to mutations that could render current COVID vaccines ineffective. And yes, the patent rights were, he explains, a gift from the U.S. to the pharmaceutical industry. Who could have guessed it? Joining us now is Ernie Canning, our, as I said, our long-toiling legal analyst and contributor at bradblog.com. He's also a retired attorney, Vietnam vet, and during the 2016 presidential campaign, a senior advisor to Veterans for Bernie. It has been a while, Mr. Canning, but welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you, Brad.
So,
good to be here.
In addition to this excellent piece you've got at BradBlog, headlined, As COVID Continues, Reagan's Gift to Big Pharma is Still Endangering Global Health. In addition to that, you recently posted another piece which sort of comes out of the same research that you were doing into the Big Pharma intellectual property rights, and a fascinating, perhaps groundbreaking response to it out here in California by our governor, Gavin Newsom. I want to get to that as well momentarily, Ernie, but your latest piece is also fascinating because it sort of explains how we got to this place in this country, really only in recent decades, where taxpayers give tens of billions to the pharmaceutical companies for R&D. That leads to miracle medicines like the COVID vaccine. But even though it was developed on our dime, the big pharma companies, they get to retain the patent and intellectual property rights and profits along with them, which means that the vaccines are not widely available around the globe, which means new variants pop up, which means more people die, which then requires new vaccines and more government money so that we can never really end the pandemic. A pretty good gig, it seems to me. And though Ronald Reagan, as you detail, plays a key role here, it wasn't always like this, as you found in your research, at least up until 1980, when Jimmy Carter actually changed the rules for how this works. Let's start with Jimmy Carter and his contributions here, and then we'll work our way up to the present day. What did Carter do in 1980 that initially changed the game when it comes to patents and IP on stuff developed with the help of government funding?
Well, in 1980, Congress passed what's called Bayh-Dole. It was Senator Birchbeyer, I think, and Bob Dole were the sponsors of it, mm-hmm. which was a modest revision of our patent laws. Up until that point, if federal monies were used for the development of any new invention, mm-hmm. the patent rights would go to the federal government. And what was happening is that they had only about 5% of the federal patents that had been accumulated between World War II and 1980 were actually going out into the market. So they wanted to increase the availability of patents, so they passed this act, which basically said that if a small business, a nonprofit, or a university mm-hmm. develops a product with the use of the federal funds for mm-hmm. R&D, that the inventor would of the university or small business would get the patent unless they specifically told them in advance that the government, for reasons of health and safety, would retain the patent. And they also included what's called march-in rights, which they could go in and if there was a need, and the government could take over the patent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, it was mainly it's to encourage, inventions which are really coming out of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. What changed with Reagan, and which makes it so hypocritical, if I can, I'll just give you a quick quote. He said, "We who live in a free market society believe that growth, prosperity, and ultimately human fulfillment are created from the bottom up, not from the government down." Well, in 1987, he turned around, and instead of having all the safeguards of Bayh-Dole, he issued an executive order that no matter how big a company was that we could, and how much money was poured in by the federal government for research and development, the patent would belong to the giant company, which in this case is the pharmaceutical industry. And if you look at the amount we've been paying about just in general research, mm-hmm. About $28 billion in pharmaceutical R&D every year, which over the span of this and what the value of those patents are, we're really talking trillions of dollars in a gift and not just tens of billions.
And so,
but in any event...
Let me unpack a little bit of that. So when Jimmy Carter did what he did in 1980, it was sort of meant as an incentive to help... again, small companies, universities, not necessarily these huge pharmaceutical industries, to invent stuff. And it wasn't just medicine, right? It was just any kind of invention that might have been helped along with federal R&D funding, correct?
Sure. If you consider, say, let's say a small business, they come up with an idea for solar panels, mm-hmm. back in 1980. Mm-hmm. That would be something where if they made the... invention, that they'd be able to keep it, even though the federal government contributed money towards developing it.
And then Reagan comes along, 1987, says that anything that gets developed, anything that gets invented with government dollars, no matter how big the company is, no matter how much they might be able to do this research and development themselves, they get to keep the patent rights, the intellectual property rights, all the profits that go along with it. He did that in an executive order in 1987?
That's correct. It didn't come from Congress. It came from an executive order.
And that took away what you described as the, the measure signed by Jimmy Carter, the right of the federal government to say, okay, you get to keep the profits. However, if it's an important invention for a life-saving medicine or something, then things change. Then the government gets to come in and keep control of those patents, correct?
Well, I don't think it took away the limitations that are imposed by Bayh-Dole, mm-hmm. for those small businesses and universities, uh-huh. but it ended being a separate gift for people that weren't covered by Bayh-Dole, which is a huge corporation, mm-hmm. of basically federal government money, socialism for the rich. Uh-huh. And, we poured all that money into it, into research and development, but at least we can say that, Americans get the benefit of paying 10 times as much for prescription drugs as anybody in any other single payer country. So there's that.
That's quite a benefit. Then we get to, so now let's bring this up to present day. We get to 2020. And COVID comes around, Donald Trump's so-called warp speed program and the development of COVID vaccines, for which companies like Pfizer and Moderna received unprecedented billions of dollars to develop in record time. Why shouldn't we be surprised that, I guess Trump was more than happy to give away the store to Big Pharma, but Joe Biden then came in. Can he simply sign an executive order that rolls back Ronald Reagan's, takes back the patent rights, and allows these drugs to be produced around the world so that we can save ourselves, if nothing else, save ourselves here in the U.S.?
Well, there's two problems with it. One is that the pharmaceutical industry, as grateful as they were for this gift, they went and locked in those patent rights in what's called the TRIPS agreement with the World Trade Organization, in order to get even a temporary waiver, which, the epidemiologists say it's critical that we provide this all over the world, uh-huh. or if we don't, then what's going to happen is you're going to keep having these new variants come up and make the original vaccines antiquated. So in order to get that waiver, you have to have the consent of every member state of the WTO, and that hasn't occurred, and that's why only 18% of the people in third world countries have been vaccinated, as opposed to 80% have had initial vaccination in wealthy countries. And the problem is that puts everybody at risk, yep, because the new variants then can come along and render what we just got obsolete in another year.
Yeah, and not to be too cynical here, of course, but that sure does work out well for the big pharmaceutical companies, doesn't it? Because they then have to put out another round of vaccines. But how do you respond, Ernie, to the argument that, hey, you know, if we don't allow these companies to profit off of their inventions, even if they come about thanks to huge R&D funding investments by the government, that they won't develop the innovative, life-saving pharmaceuticals that we all need?
Well, I know how Governor Newsom responded.
Well,
he came up with, you know, I mean, California is going to manufacture its own generic insulin.
Well, that's where we're headed here. I'll point folks, of course, to your fascinating research on this on bradblog.com on both of these stories, because I think this is the story that actually led you into the research into patent and IP issues. California's new plan, just signed by the Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, will actually put the state now into the business of producing pharmaceuticals itself. In this case, insulin, which you describe as a shot in the arm, if you will, towards socialized medications and the end of patent abuse. So, yeah, give me a quick idea. What is our state now doing, and just how revolutionary is this, or isn't this, at least here in the U.S.?
Insulin is a classic case, because it shows you how the industry manipulates our patent laws. You know, insulin was discovered in 1921. Up until about 1980, most of the insulin was from cows and pigs, and then a researcher developed human insulin, and they started doing that in around 1978. Well, mm-hmm. What happens is, patents, the length of a patent is supposed to be limited, mm-hmm. Because it's a conflict between you wanting to encourage people to develop inventions, but then you want the public to be able to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So the longest a patent is supposed to last is 20 years. Well, insulin's been around for over 100 years, and we're still finding what it is. What the industry did was, when the human patent on human insulin started to reach what they call a patent cliff, where it's going to expire,
mm-hmm.
they develop what are called analog insulins. And then what they do is they shift, instead of making the human insulin available, they go to the analog insulins, which would, you know, be brand name, and they could charge more money.
Mm-hmm.
And then now that those analogs are starting the patents are starting to expire, what they do is they just keep new analog insulins in the R&D development thing, even though, you know, the government's paying for these all the way, and that way they can continue to bring new insulins and keep it forever. Well, because of that kind of abuse, it wasn't until last year, which is 100 years after insulin was discovered, that the FDA first approved a generic insulin. And what Governor Newsom has done is California is going to put in $100 million into the manufacture and distribution to Californians at slightly above cost of their own mm-hmm. generic insulin. That's their response. The other interesting thing was that the other approach is what's called, you know, as far as with the manufactured stuff, is to have a single negotiator system, which they have in the VA, and just now with the new act, CMS is now going to have it. But they don't. If they had it for the entire country, you could negotiate the prices. That's where Americans were paying 10 times as much as other countries. But even in the other countries, people are being ripped off, because they keep manufacturing these new analog insulins. Mm-hmm. And a study by the World Health Organization found that there's no significant difference in terms of the clinical value between analog insulin and the human insulin.
So,
and yet they're coming up with new generations, which we don't need.
So California and the governor said, well, the hell with that. We will just make the insulin ourselves. We'll sell it for really cheap. And we don't have to deal with it. I mean, I know in that new law you referenced, the Inflation Reduction Act, in which Democrats had attempted to limit the cost of insulin to no more than $35 a month for anyone who needed it, but Republicans blocked that measure, so the $35 a month cap will now only apply to those who have government insurance like Medicare. Great news, of course, for folks on Medicare, but bad news for those with private insurance, young people suffering with juvenile diabetes and so forth. So California's move sort of seems to work around that entirely. Has this been done before in the U.S., either by California or any other state, to your knowledge, that we're getting in the medication business out here in the state?
Actually, my research showed that the only other country I could find which is manufacturing its own generic medications, basically socialized medication, was Cuba. So the rest of the world, nobody else has done it. That shows how far out Newsom has gone. I might back up a minute to what you said about just repealing the Reagan executive order.
Yeah.
That might work with regard to President Biden could repeal that order with respect to any new medications or vaccinations that are not already developed or in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't work for those that are already existing, because you'd have problems not only with the WTO trade agreements, but also with the Fifth Amendment taking clause. These companies have a vested right based on, and they've relied on the fact that these were going to belong to them, and they do belong to them, so they have a vested right in those patents. What Biden? There are two things Biden could do. One would be to pull in the CEOs of Moderna and Pfizer to the White House and say, "Look, if you guys don't agree to waive your patents on these COVID vaccinations." Mm-hmm. I can repeal that order as to all future pharmaceutical products, which would be worth tons of money to these people over the years. Mm-hmm. And that might work. The alternative would be for Congress to step in and modify Reagan's executive order to contain the same safeguards that they had with respect to Bayh-Dole for the universities and small businesses, and apply that to these pharmaceutical manufacturers and have the ability to step in where health is at stake.
And so, in short, the horse is out of the barn, or whatever that is, when it comes to COVID. We've already sort of made an agreement with these companies. It's difficult to claw back the profits or the patent rights. But certainly going forward, Joe Biden could sign an executive order that basically repeals what Ronald Reagan did in 1987 to prevent this sort of mess from continuing, as if Joe Biden doesn't have enough on his plate already. But I hope he will consider it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how this experiment, if you will, in state socialized produced medications out here in California works under Gavin Newsom with the creation of insulin. All fascinating stuff. Great work, Ernie. Really interesting research. I will, of course, point folks to both of your articles at bradblog.com. The more recent, "As COVID Continues, Reagan's Gift to Big Pharma is Still Endangering Global Health." And from a week or so ago, "California's New Insulin Plan, a Shot in the Arm Towards Socialized Medications, Ending Patent Abuse." Ernie Canning, you can find him, as I said, at bradblog.com and on the Twitters as well. He is Canning, C-A-N-N, the number 4, I-N-G. Don't ask me why, but that's where you'll find him, at Twitter. Ernie Canning, thanks a bunch, my friend. Look forward to talking to you soon.
You're more than welcome, Brad.
Thank you. Okay, fascinating. Both of those articles, really fascinating.
Oh, I know.
And with history I was not aware of.
Yeah, I did. I had no idea about any of that history. And it just really underscores for me yet again how elections have consequences. I mean, the election of Governor Gavin Newsom. We now have introducing in our own insulin here in the state.
Manufacturing our own insulin.
In California. And then we're still dealing with the fallout from the 1980 election and all the stuff that Ronald Reagan did to dismantle all of these protections and other common sense regulations that helped prevent these predatory corporations from just stripping everything for parts.
Predatory indeed. You know, I've never understood, in a case like a worldwide pandemic, which I guess is saying the same thing twice, a pandemic,
yeah,
a deadly pandemic, that these companies who invented these miracle vaccines, why they just can't find a way to do the right thing.
To earn just a couple of few dollars less.
Make the recipe available to all. They can still, you know, take a piece of the profit. They built these things thanks to billions of dollars in our taxpayer money. Can you find a way to give back at all? At all? Apparently not. Let's take a quick break here. There is one company this week that actually appears to be doing that, exactly that. And I have become so cynical that I'm sure there must be something I'm not understanding about this. Well, we'll come back and talk about it after this quick break. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Give a little bit of your love to me.
A little bit. They're giving $3 billion. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So when I first heard about this story, by way of measure, as I said, of how cynical we have all become, I think, I assumed there had to be more to it. There was some gimmick. There was something that was not being reported. But if so, I got to say, I have yet to be able to find it. But please, if you have, please drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com if you have learned otherwise. But the founder of the outdoor brand Patagonia has relinquished his ownership in the business and directed its profits, all of them, to fight climate change. Rather than sell the company or take it public, Yvonne Chouinard, if I'm saying that correctly, his wife and his two adult children have transferred their ownership of Patagonia, valued at about $3 billion, to a specially designed trust and a nonprofit organization. They were created to preserve the company's independence and ensure that all of its profits, some $100 million per year, are used to combat climate change and protect underdeveloped land around the globe. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that seems to me
hugely, hugely, hugely cool.
$3 billion, and they're just giving it away. Yvonne Chouinard, if that's how you say his name, apologies if it isn't. I don't want to offend him in case he wants to, you know, share any of that. Sweet, sweet. Anyway, he became famous for alpine climbs in Yosemite National Park. And then as a manufacturer of outdoor gear, he's transferred his family's ownership of Patagonia to these two new entities. According to a press release from the company on Wednesday, quote, instead of extracting value from nature and transforming it into wealth, we are using the wealth Patagonia creates to protect the source. We're making Earth our only shareholder, the 83-year-old Chouinard said in a statement. Kind of amazing. In a letter to customers, Chouinard said Patagonia is now owned by a trust that will determine the company's direction and a new nonprofit group called the Hold Fast Collective, which is dedicated to protecting nature and other environmental causes. Chouinard wrote, while we're doing our best to address the environmental crisis, it's not enough. Each year, the money we make after reinvesting in the business will be distributed as a dividend to help fight the crisis. Pretty cool. Dennis Hayes, who coordinated the first Earth Day and later became the CEO of the environmentally focused Bullet Foundation in Seattle, said that Chouinard has long been a strident environmentalist, willing to make bold moves and challenge convention. He said, quote, apparently they're putting it into the structure that will institutionalize it beyond his lifetime. Hayes said the concept of putting this together in a new structure and being experimental and bold is exactly the kind of innovation we need to be trying. Well, easy for him to say. Anyway, I thought that there must be something insidious about all of this, something that I wasn't understanding, that it was some scheme or another to, you know, make the company look good. So I didn't want to report on it right away. But so far, and, you know, if you found something else, let me know, bradcast@bradblog.com. The most that I've been able to find is that in transferring all of his money, all of this money and future profits for the company to a trust and a nonprofit, that his kids will avoid a bunch of inheritance taxes. Then again, they will also avoid a bunch of inheritance.
This is true.
So really, if anybody, it's the government that will lose out here because they won't get those inheritance taxes. But I suspect a nonprofit set up by this guy to combat climate change will probably go much farther than that money would if it was sent as taxes to the U.S. government.
Oh, definitely. I think that he'll be able, the company now will be able to direct it to where it is needed most and have a more involvement in, mm-hmm. in how those projects come about. And, you know, I think that he also is protecting the company and the company's employees from being taken over by a hedge fund if he'd gone to any of those other directions.
Right.
And, you know, this environmental protection and climate change, that is part of his DNA. His entire life has been devoted to trying to figure out how you can both make a living and protect the earth at the same time.
Well, he nailed it.
I don't expect any other CEOs to do that.
Well, they should. Giving away $3 billion, essentially, and $100 million a year thereafter. Just extraordinary. Kudos to them.
Yes.
I don't own any Patagonia products, I don't think, but I may consider buying some now. Contrast that, by the way, with Pfizer and Moderna and all the free money that they're getting from the government.
And hoarding.
And hoarding. And hoarding the profits, hoarding the IP rights. Man, I guess it takes a lot to do what he did there. Chouinard, in this case.
It shouldn't take a lot to do what he's done, but you're right, it does.
It does. So good for them. But again, let me know, bradcast@bradblog.com, if I'm missing something here. There's got to be something. Something evil and terrible has to really actually be going on
here. No, there doesn't.
Got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Ernest A. Canning of The Brad Blog, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Did you hear that, Yvonne Chouinard? Bradblog.com/donate. Just saying. You can drop me email, bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.